forward to it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of the 1973 podcast with somebody I've been dying to get on the show. USA Hockey Hall of Famer, published author of the book You Want to Go, NHL referee legend, Paul Stewart. Paul, can't wait. We're so proud and happy to have you on.
Well, it's always nice to talk to fellow Massachusetts residents, and you're from the southeastern Mass section, the mostly overlooked that and the Chicopee area. The people in Boston forget that these sections are a big part of our state.
Yeah, huge hockey area too, kind of gets overlooked down this way, but we're gonna start right into it. I just want to know, as three Massachusetts guys and you being from Massachusetts, how did your career start from start to the World Hockey League? Let's start with that.
Like many of the others, my family, and when I say many of the others who are in the sport, excluding, say, a guy like Kachuk and his two boys, because he's given them, a pretty good start. And their mom was from Winnipeg, so she had that Canadian influence. But my grandfather was the first American to referee in the NHL. And during his officiating career, he would see all of the teams. And of course, they had the original six, but back then I think there were seven and sometimes eight teams. St. Louis had a team, Pittsburgh had a team for a while, Brooklyn had a team, the New York Americans. And my grandfather was a professional baseball player playing in the Chicago White Sox system. And he was there in Montreal pre-World War I, in Montreal pitching for the Montreal Royals. And World War I came along with the US entering, and he resigned from baseball and joined the US Navy, where he was stationed in Boston, of all places, and running a coastal gun in what is now Hull, Mass. And I think on the weekends he was pitching for the US Navy team. And his wife was a Canadian from Nova Scotia that he had met when she was in Montreal with her sister, who was the Mother Superior of the Sisters of Charity. And they, of course, were very big in Nova Scotia when Nova Scotia and Dartmouth blew up in 1917 when the John Bart, the ammunition ship exploded in the Narrows in Halifax Harbor. And they came back to Boston, and Mr. Brown, who ran the Boston Arena, which is where the Boston Tiger Cubs played, which was a predecessor of the Bruins, and they had the only indoor multipurpose facility at the Boston Arena built in 1912. Sadly, they're going to tear it down this year, and I'm surprised that no one ever turned it into a historical landmark. But Mr. Brown had my grandfather running the ice crew, and there was a picture of him behind the horse pulling the plow, scraping the ice, and they used 55-gallon drums of hot water. And Mr. Brown, of course, would later be known to be the president of the Boston Garden. They built that in 1928. And my grandfather, in the meantime, was coaching Milton Academy. He was coaching Harvard. He was coaching MIT. He started two women's teams at Radcliffe and Emmanuel College. And it was interesting because he'd go back to baseball in the summer. And of course, in the summer of 1919, he was with the Chicago White Sox and Shoeless Joe Jackson, in Mineral Wells, Texas, for spring training. And of course, that's the year that the White Sox threw the series. He came back to Boston and was coaching, and I think probably pinch hitting as a referee. And he joined, and he was gaining experience in that Can-Am, Can-American League, which had New Haven and Boston, and I think Three Rivers or Sherbrooke had a team. At any rate, the National Hockey League came along, and he was a referee, and he joined the NHL as a referee in 1928. And 10 years later, the owner of Chicago Blackhawks had a desire to put a team together of all Americans. And my grandfather was the only American in the league, and he had coaching experience. And Major McLaughlin, who had been a major in the Blackhawk Division of World War I, hired him. And he became the general manager and coach of the Chicago Blackhawks. He had nine Americans on his team, including Moose Heiliger. His brother Vic was on the team later, the coach at Air Force Academy. But Moose Heiliger, if you recall, the Band of Brothers, he was the lieutenant that replaced Major Winters, and then he was shot by the sentry, and they were from Concord, Mass. And there were Mike Karakas, the goaltender, was from St. Paul, and so he had a good team, and they won the Stanley Cup. In the summers, because he was injured in baseball, he started to umpire, and at the same time he was an NHL referee, he was a Major League umpire in the National League, and he worked 22 years in the National League, five World Series, four All-Star games. He worked the Bobby Thompson three-game series with the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Giants. And of course, the Giants win the pennant, and he was the crew chief. And that was game three, and he was at second base. And you can see him twirling his hand when the home run was hit for the Giants to win the pennant. He went on, after winning the Stanley Cup, into the next season, and the major, who had 18 coaches in 18 years, fired him. And wouldn't you know, he went back to the NHL as a referee. I always wished that I had had the chance to talk to him and ask him how that worked and how he, but he'd commanded respect, and he was a tough guy. In the meantime, his only son, my dad, went to English High, and he went to English High with a guy named Bill Flynn, who became the athletic director at Boston College. And they grew up together on Galvin Boulevard in Dorchester, right near Walsh Park. And they were so young when they get out of English High in 1936 that they went to Lawrence Academy for 2 years. And then my dad matriculated to Notre Dame because my grandfather was coaching the Hawks, and Bill Flynn went to BC. World War II came along. My dad returned to Boston as a teacher at the UMass Extension School, which was at Fort Devens, and he was coaching football and hockey, and he got his master's degree, and he started teaching in 1947 at Boston English, where he did 37 years. He missed 12 days of school. He was also the athletic director. He was the football, hockey, and baseball coach, and the last several years of his career, he was the headmaster of the school. In the meantime, on the weekends, with the influence of his father being a two-sport major league official, my dad didn't see much of his father. So he decided that if he was going to officiate, he was going to stay just at the college level. He worked the College World Series in Omaha. He worked Division One or Major League College hockey, did 19 bean pots, did the first one in 1952 at the old Boston Arena. And as well, he worked, I watched him work the Pitt Navy game. I watched him work at West Point. I watched him work at Harvard. I chased balls as the ball boy at Cornell when Gogolak was kicking there. And the title of my book, which I'll show now, is You Want to Go. And a lot of people think that's what two fighters say to one another, Terry O'Reilly and myself, we fought. But it's also something my dad used to say, I'm going to Harvard tonight. You want to go? And with him officiating three sports, baseball, hockey, and football. I was 3 feet behind him and pretty well indoctrinated into the aspect of watching teams like BU play and BC and all of the great players, Johnny Cunniff and Jackie Parker at BU, excuse me, and the Clearys at Harvard. And it was just my immersion into sports and seeing the respect that my grandfather would get when he went to Fenway Park and Mr. and Mrs. Yawkey would greet him and all of the umpires would be glad to see him. And then we'd go to the garden and, the famous ex-Bruin Milt Schmidt would come over to say hi. And, it was just the signs of respect that he got, and the same with my dad, that pushed me toward an athletic life. And what was most interesting was that I grew up in Dorchester and I ended up at one of the most elite prep schools in the country, Groton School. The alumni include Franklin Roosevelt and Dean Acheson and Fred Gwynne, Herman Munster. And so I was able to academically do well there, and I went on to the University of Pennsylvania, and we had a varsity team at the time, and I also played baseball. I turned down a full scholarship to Lafayette to play football. I was all league in every sport, and I played well, and I was tough, and I didn't ever believe when people said I wasn't that good that they were right. I thought that little bit of Dorchester in me made me a little better than what a lot of other people might have thought. And I didn't. I played freshman hockey at Penn, played baseball, and then sophomore year I was the all-star in 5 games, or star of the game 5 games. And my junior year I went to camp and got cut, and I didn't play at all my junior year. But my work study job at school was at the rink, at the class of 23 rink at the University of Pennsylvania. And of all things that you could imagine that would be happening, was that the Philadelphia Flyers practiced at our rink. And a lot of times I got to skate with them. And I was constantly urged by those guys, and I think they understood. Things weren't good for me on the team, the varsity team, but they told me, never quit. And I would hit the bag and lift weights and run and do all the things that they were doing. And then once in a while, I'd get to skate with them. And I skated every day at the practice for Penn, but I never played. And senior year, I played 3 games in the early fall, and the school announced in December that they were closing because of the oil embargo in 1975, and they were closing for the winter term and wouldn't start up again until April. So I left school. Two guys from Boston, Steve Sterling, who played at BU, and Richie Hart, for a Charlestown guy, played for my dad at English, played at Boston College. Sterling played at BU, as I said. They got me a tryout in Binghamton. And that was the league that they filmed Slapshot. So I went to Binghamton, $14 bus ticket from Philadelphia. I played 46 games. I set a record for penalty minutes because I knew that I hadn't the experience that the Canadian players had. And I bought time for myself and space by being the tough guy that I was. And what having watched the Flyers win Stanley Cups the way they played, I knew I could make it. And I did. And the next year, the Rangers signed me, went to New Haven. I went back to Binghamton. And then I jumped to the WHA. I played in Edmonton and Cincinnati and played with Mark Messier, was my roommate, Billy Gilligan, the All-American from Beverly that played at Brown. I played with Robbie Fatorik, who was a great player from Needham. And I pretty well carried Robbie's bags from the bus to the plane and the plane to the bus, and made sure that No one was after him, and which is the reason why later, when he went to Quebec, Quebec drafted me from the WHA expansion, and my first game with Quebec was against the Bruins, and I had what I tell people is the Dorchester hat trick. And I fought O'Reilly, Jonathan, and Secord in a row. But I also had a fight in the pregame with Cashman with sticks at center ice. And they were testing me and they found out. But if you get my book, you'll notice that Terry O'Reilly wrote the foreword and he was the first guy I fought. And it to me is a great sign of respect and also a significant testimony about what a class guy Terry O'Reilly is. And I thanked him after I fought him for putting me on the map. And then I fought Jonathan. And then I thought I was going to have to fight Wensink, but this guy Secord came along. He was just a rookie. And that wasn't much of a goal, but I said to him, you know, next time you want to go, we'll just go to center ice and give them their money's worth. And on the way off the rink, and you can watch the YouTube of the fights of that particular night, I stop at the Bruins bench, which is where the visitors had to go off, and I turned and waved. And a lot of people thought I, and people have said, you know, I gave the crowd the finger and all that. That's not true at all. My neighbor here, I live on Cape Cod. And my neighbor was a nice little boy named Christus Caldas. And he and his buddies used to come up to my driveway when in the summer when I'd be shooting pucks or hitting the bag or lifting weights. I had a gym in my garage. And I said to his sister one day, Christus is so, he seems so tired all the time. And she said, he's got leukemia. So that night before that Bruins game, I went to see that kid in the hospital. And I told him, you watch me tomorrow night. And when I get finished, I'm going to wave to you. And that's what I did.
Awesome. Awesome.
So that's a long story for your first question, but you asked how I got
Fantastic,
into
Paul.
sports. You know, I didn't look at it as something I did after school. I looked at it as my family's business.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, what a story with so much in packed in with a family history and the whole journey right into the World Hockey League, exactly, what we asked for. So, my next question is, what made you decide to hang up the skates and pick up the whistle?
Well, I had some personal issues in 1980 after my first year in Quebec. I was contracted to play another year in Quebec, and the differential in money is about 35%. And I was making $75,000, which was a lot of money at that time, considering that guys, like Tardif and Fatorik and that were made, probably making 250, and Bobby Hull was making probably around that. So my amount of money, I was making twice what Stan Jonathan was making with the Bruins, and I was in Quebec, and I was making 65, $70,000, $75,000, and they had to pay me in U.S., and they could go get other players for half the cost. So I went to the Buffalo Sabres training camp, and at the time I was married to a person who was sour on the whole thing about hockey, and I made a decision to try to save my marriage, and I came home, and I found out that I wasn't quite ready to give it up, and I tried to get back. And it's pretty tough when you're 29 and a tough guy, and you start to slow down. The kids are getting bigger and stronger and such. And, I was going to have to wade through the rest of the world again. And I came down to the Cape. I was coaching the high school team. I was a police officer in Yarmouth. I had a radio show at night. I sold cars. I did a lot of things to try to make a living and find my niche. And I was teaching school. I did a lot of things. I was a night manager at a laundromat folding people's clothes. And, I was never lazy, and I never was that pompous of a guy to think that I couldn't work or shouldn't work. and I've always worked. And so that pretty well ended my career. I went and played a couple games for Billy Horton up in Utica. He needed a defenseman for a playoff game or two. And then I was doing what my dad did. I was coaching and refereeing, and the Cape Cod Officials Association had a meeting, and I went to it. And after the meeting, they five or six of the fellows, the respected officials, one of them was a state trooper, and another one ran the Oceanographic Institute in Falmouth. And they were all accomplished people. And they took me out for pizza after the officials meeting. And they starkly said to me, pretty candidly, you shouldn't be refereeing on Cape Cod, and you shouldn't be doing high school. And I thought I had done something wrong. And they said to me, you should be in the National Hockey League. And I had tried to do college hockey, and the fellow that was running it was a guy I played against. He was at Harvard, and he was running the ECAC. And he told me that because of my suspect style of play, that I was not the type of person they were looking for as a referee. And I kind of laughed at him. I had played against him. He played at Harvard. And you know, Harvard guys, they're all smarter than everyone. So I said to him, this wouldn't have anything to do with the night I played against you and wrapped your mask around your face. And I said, the next time you watch me work, you'll pay to get in. And I called Harry Sinden, and I talked to Dale Hamilton Powers, who was Harry's secretary, and asked her for the number of the people who were in charge of officiating for the NHL. And I called, and I got Scotty Morrison, and he remembered me, and he knew my grandfather, and he brought me to Bruce Hood's referee school. And I went up there, and it was like a tryout, and I was there for a week or 10 days. And I went home, not really sure what was going to happen. And about a week later, they called me and said, we'd like you to be here September 9th for our training camp, and we're going to give you the opportunity to become an NHL referee. And I went through a couple years of working in the minors and working junior hockey. I worked the Western League, and I worked Ontario League. I worked Quebec. I was working Division III college hockey, and you know, and I was working the prep school league, ISL. And I just, like, one year for the NHL as a trainee, I worked 147 games in a row with no nights off. And I'm going from Boston to Salt Lake to Portland to Seattle to New Westminster, which is in Vancouver, and going to Swift Current and Moose Jaw, and all the way across Canada, and then all the way back. And I was going 37 games in 39 nights. And then I came home for 10 days, or maybe not even that, and went back out for another 40 days. Worked another 35 games. And John McCauley, who was the referee in chief, his son is Wes McCauley. John passed away on June 6th, 1989. Terrible day in my life. He was my mentor. And Scotty Morrison was the guy that saved me. Because when a player or any athlete leaves what they've done their whole life, there's a void. And some people fill the void with, you know, successful careers post hockey, and they get a lot of chances. But when you're a tough guy and you have more penalty minutes and you have goals and assists, those don't always happen. But I had a good education, and I had a good background, and I could always teach school. I speak several languages and things like that. But you know, hockey was my life, and I wanted to be back in it. So all of the sacrifices to become a referee, I just looked at hockey the way my dad looked at it and my grandfather. You know, you do one thing, but it doesn't mean you can't do two or three other things at the same time. And if you're understanding my mind, you'll understand that it wasn't so much about the money, and it wasn't about the, you know, the ego or anything like that. It was about wanting to be like my dad and wanting to be like my grandfather, who had been very successful and accomplished and had had good lives, and they did a lot of good things. And from my efforts as a player, I was honest and I was tough, but it helped me become a better referee. And it's like having been a cop. You put a gun on and you have life and death. And they talk about defunding the police. They should double their funding and do more psychological testing and more training to give these guys and women the right frame of mind to go out there and wield the power. When you're a referee in the NHL and you have the whistle and you have those armbands, you can pretty well dictate the show if you want to. But my efforts were to be honest, let the boys play. And Frank Advari, who was a Hall of Famer, said to me one night in Springfield, if they did it to you and you'd be ticked off, that's penalty. If they did it to your teammate and you'd want to jump over the boards and fight them, that's a penalty. And if you're sitting on the end of the bench and your teammate does something stupid to someone else and you put your hand over your head and shake your head, that's a penalty. You don't need any more teaching. That's feel the game. And that's what I brought to my 20 years of officiating. I'm the first American to referee 1,000 games in the NHL. I'm the only American to ever play in the NHL and then go and officiate. And then I got from the game what I hadn't got at college and maybe even at prep school and other places when, people made a point of laughing at me or mocking me or almost hazing, that I wasn't that good, or they did things to make my life difficult and miserable. But I was a tough guy, and they couldn't get rid of me because I was tough. And I just persisted and overcame all the obstacles and all the negative criticisms. And basically, what it came down to is I'm at the 2000 All-Star game, and I asked to go out and make a presentation on behalf of Hockey Fights Cancer. I was the honorary ambassador. And I walk into the room, and there's a dinner with all of the senior, all, you know, senior heroes of hockey. And guess what? I walk in, and Gordie Howe stands up and comes over and shakes my hand. And Bobby Hull. And Jean Beliveau says, come sit with us, Paul. Now, those guys are the most respected people in the game at that time. And Gretzky asked, his father and mother used to invite me to their house, and I'd go to the golf tournaments. And I got what I was looking for. I got the acknowledgement and I gained the respect. And that's why, as a Hall of Fame guy and all of that, I take it very seriously to act in a manner that's becoming of the status that I've earned. And I'm in a position to help people, and especially kids. And this is part of the reason why I'm doing the show, even though I have one eye on the TV watching Dallas and Edmonton. Because the game is still a major part of my life, but I also respect that you fellas, had honored me by inviting me to be on your show. And that's why I'm here.
Stewie, I can't thank you enough. I want to rewind and ask you about do you remember the first NHL game that you did as an official?
Yeah, I was working in the American League, and John McCauley used to say to me, I'm going to be in New York tonight, and you're in New Haven when the game tomorrow. I want you to come to New York and sit with me. Or Frank Advari would be there, Hall of Fame guy, or John Ashley, or Scotty, or any of the people that were supervisors. And on March 26th, 1986, it was the end of the toward the end of the season. Maybe there was a week or 10 days left, and they had the four divisions, and the Bruins were in the Adams division with Hartford, and Boston was also up against Montreal for second place in that division, home ice in the playoffs. And Macaulay called me and asked me to come. And I always brought my uniform, my equipment, because you never knew. And that was just a habit and a standard practice for officials. If they went to a game, that they had to have their equipment. And the first period ended, and about 2.5, 3 minutes into the second period, Dave Newell was the referee with Asseltine and Stickle on the lines. The captain of Montreal was a European guy, and he took Newell up into the dasher right by the Montreal bench, and there was no padding on the stanchion, and Newell broke his ribs and he went down. And I was sitting with Macaulay. I think we were both reaching into the popcorn at the same time, and Stickle looked up at John. They were both, Asseltine and Stickle, were kneeling down over Newell, Dave Newell's body on the ice, and they shook their head and they made the signal, pointed to their ribs, broken ribs. Macaulay touched my hand and said, "Go get dressed." And it was Montreal and Boston for first place or second place at the time, home ice, and Hartford was right within a point. And so I went downstairs and I got dressed and I came out. And I had forgotten to tape my pads to my skates, and I rolled up my pants and I borrowed some tape at the end of the Bruins bench, and Bork was there and he says, "Geez, we've been waiting a long time." And Milbury made a smart ass comment by saying, "Took you long enough to get here." I said, "Yeah, just about 5 years." But I went out and I did great for the first 30 seconds or so, and then the Bruins. Casper corralled the puck on the left wing board. Patrick Waugh was in the net and he passed it over, and Courtnall took a shot, and Waugh was a goaltender that was one of the first to use that butterfly, and he flopped and he held his chest, and I thought, and with those cardinal red uniforms, and they got sweaty. I thought I saw the puck up against his chest, and I was within 10 feet of the net, but I didn't see. The puck had slipped between Waugh's legs and was lying on the crease line, and I blew the whistle. And about a second or so after I blew the whistle, Courtnall bopped it in. That would have been the winning goal. Boston tied that game. Hartford went on and won the next night against the Bruins, and they finished a point ahead. And Montreal, Jean Perron was the coach, and Serge Dvar was going to fire him if they hadn't tied or won that night. They ended up tying, and of course, Montreal went on and won the Stanley Cup that year. Jean Perron got a new contract, but he never sent me any dough, so I don't know if he appreciated my efforts. That was my first game. And the next night I was in Baltimore in an American League game, and that game had been on national TV, and Sam from the Rangers was the announcer, and it was quite something, and everybody in Baltimore must have been watching because I heard all about it. But you
We
know
did.
what? I showed up, and Macaulay said to me afterwards, "The one thing I'm going to tell you, early off, a lot of guys would have started to have knee knocking and a little puddle underneath their skates." And he said, "You never quit. You didn't back down from anybody." He said, "You went out and refereed that game, and you could have looked at it as a mistake, but you made the right call. You lost sight of the puck, and you blew the whistle." It was funny because Bork skated up to me about a second after. Of course, Roy's going, "You blew the whistle. You blew the," he's French. "You blew the whistle." And I said, "Yeah, I know I blew the whistle. Don't worry about it." And then Bork skated up. He said, "Coach wants to talk to you." And it was the guy that had played for the Islanders. And he wore Butch Goring, and he had worn that funny helmet. And And in fact, I did the first game. I played the first game against Butch when he got traded from LA to the Islanders, and he had a hat trick against us that night, and knocked us out of the playoffs. So I guess it might have been poetic justice, but that was well off. I wasn't even in my mind. I looked around Bork and I see Goring standing on the bench, and he's giving it to Billy Graham with the arms and the veins on his neck. Who they looked like two lobsters from Maine. And all I said was to Bork, I think we'll just drop the puck and I'll talk to him after. I
Stewie,
don't think I've ever talked to
is there a
him.
moment that sticks with you better for worse about something that you did during the game? That, do you have a moment that you just can't get out of your head that happened while you're officiating?
Well, I concluded that year finishing up working the American League playoffs. I went back down, and that was March. The Stanley Cup started just a week or so later. So I went back down. I worked the Calder Cup Finals in Hershey. The next year, I started working in the National League. And I worked the playoffs, and I did all sorts of things that a lot of people not thought I'd never do. But I just looked at it as the progression of what I did. Along the way, there are always moments where you make a mistake, and there are other moments where you wish you could have had it back. And I think overall, for the most part, that one in Boston stood out. But the next year, in 87, the Six Nations, Russia and Canada and the Czechs and the Swedes, the Finns and the Americans played the Canada Cup, which was a similar type of tournament as they had in 72 with the Russians, just the Russians. But now it was six teams. And I was chosen as the American representative. And I worked a bunch of games in the preliminary rounds, the Finns and the Swedes, and tough games and such. But what was interesting is one of the referees had a tough game in Montreal, and he actually was my roommate. And he at training camp, and he had a tough game. I watched the game at Quincy Market. And the next day, I got on a plane and flew to Toronto. And I got to Toronto on Saturday night, and we had a meeting. And McCauley caught my eye. I was at the back of the room, and I was sitting next to Dave Newell and Andy Van Helman, another famous referee. And what do you think happens? McCauley catches my eye, and he points at me, and he pointed to the door, and he's And he got up and walked. So I knew he was talking to me. So I went. I followed him out. And we walked down the hall a little bit. And there was a set of stairs. And we walked down three, four stairs. He didn't want to be in the hallway in the ballroom area. And he looked at me and he shook my hand and, welcome. Good to see you again and everything. He said, "Let me ask you, what are you doing tomorrow night?" And I said, "Well, tomorrow's the first day of training camp. We usually get our physicals and we get our equipment and then we skate and then we usually go to the keg, which is, like a tradition." Oh, Edmonton just scored. And we do that and watch the game. I probably watched the game. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "You'll be watching. But you will be watching from the ice. You're working the game." It was game two. In the game one, Koharski had worked, and I worked game two. And when he announced, and I was working with John D'Amico, who was a Hall of Famer, and I was working with a Swedish guy, Lundstrom, Sven Lundstrom. And when he announced that to the room with all the officials, you could have heard a pin drop. They were in shock. Because I had only ever worked one half of an NHL game. And I went down there to Hamilton in John D'Amico's car. And my brother was head of US Customs in Toronto. And he was stationed there. at the airport, and he came along with us. And I was standing on the bench, and I had a three-piece suit on, and I had my grandfather's Stanley Cup watch on. It was a pocket watch with a fob, in my vest. And Fran Rosa, the Bruins, the Boston Globe reporter, he caught me. He wanted to talk to me before the game, and he said to me, I used to go and sit with your dad, and he would teach me the game. He said, and now it's and he said, and I watched your grandfather referee. He said, what do you think about being here? I said, I feel like George Patton. What do you mean? I said, I'm the right guy in the right place with the right equipment. And I
Yeah.
was born to be here. And I went out and refereed that game. And like that first game, I fought O'Reilly and Jonathan and Secord and Cashman. That game put me on the map. And when the game was over, and it went to two overtimes, and when the game was over, the Russians lost 6-5. And this was when the Fetisov was captain, and Larionov and Yakushev and Krutov and all those guys were all the famous. Trechak wasn't playing; it was Mushkin, but they were all playing, and I earned their respect. Even though I disallowed two of their goals for legitimate reasons, and Canada won 6-5, and I went in the dressing room, and McCauley came in and said, I was taking my skate off, and he touched my foot, and I looked up, and he just said to me, "Superb."
Nice.
That's
Then he
awesome.
said to me, "I want to talk to you." So I followed him into the washroom. And he said to me, "The Russians and the Canadian committee are going to come in here, and they want you to referee Tuesday night." This was September 13th, and so the 15th was going to be the game three. And I said, "Oh wow!" And it was $2,500 too. And I said, "Oh, what a thrill! What a treat!" He said, "Yeah. But I had had a knee operation in July." And he said to me, "I want you to put an ice bag on your knee. And when they come in, I want you to thank them and tell them that your knee's sore and you can't work." And I said, "Why is that, John?" And my dad had said to me, "Whatever John McCauley says to you, you do it." In other words, it's like I'm talking to you. And I said, "Okay." So I said, "John, just curious, why wouldn't I work?" He said, "Because you just proved to all those people that never thought you were going to be a referee that you're one of the best."
Nice.
He said, "And if you screwed up Tuesday night, you'd just give them ammo." He said, "So that one game would come from their committee, but the next 80 in the NHL will come from me."
Nice.
And I just looked at him and said, "Yes, sir." And I put the ice bag on my knee, and Eagleson was the chairman of that committee, and Mike Keenan was the coach, and the Russian coach. They all came in, and I didn't get up. I just had the ice bag on my knee, and I said, "And yet, I can't skate. No, I can't." And I said, "My knee's sore." And I worked a full game in two overtimes. And you're looking at that Canadian team, and you're looking at their power play, and it's Coffey and Bourque and Messier and Lemieux and Gretzky. I mean, I was on the ice with the best players in the world, and I could skate. And that's probably my biggest thrill. So would I wish I had anything to do over again? That's like Frank Sinatra. You have regrets, and you have a few, but the only one I regret is when I was playing, and I was playing for the Rangers in Madison Square Garden against, of all people, the Flyers, who were all friends of mine. And I got tossed after 1 minute, one shift. I had bought $700 worth of tickets for my family to see me in my first NHL game as a player, and I got tossed. But, those things happen. And of all things, the official that tossed me was John McCauley.
Irony.
It might have been the thing that caused him to think, that guy might be a pretty good referee.
Well, Stewie, I got to ask you because you've mentioned so many names so far, but who were some of the players that were very tough to officiate, and who were some of the surprising players that respected the officials?
It's funny because I had played against a lot of the European players in the teams when I was playing. And when I was in Cincinnati in the WHA, we played the Russians and we played the Czechs, and they knew me. I was a force on the ice. I mean, I was a big kid and tough, and everybody talks about, oh, watch out for this guy, oh, watch out for that. But I gained respect because I played hard, but I didn't play dirty. And I think I played against Gretzky's first game in pro. He was playing for Indianapolis and I was playing for Cincinnati. The game was in Dayton. Pat Stapleton was the coach, and he had been my teammate the year before in Cincinnati. And I had gone and stayed at his house in the summer, and he had a farm and all that. His father used to come to Cape Cod and stay in my house. And Whitey wanted me to come to Indianapolis to protect Gretzky, but I got more money in Cincinnati, so I stayed in Cincy, and it turned out it was a mistake, but that happens. But I mean, I played against Gretzky, and I played against guys like Glenn Sather and other different people. But for the most part, when you're in a situation and you're playing against Bobby Hull, and you run into him and it's like hitting a concrete wall, it's unbelievable. And he was so much of a pro, because when the game was over, he sought me out and gave me a few tips. I played against Gordie Howe my first shift. I said to him, I named my dog after you when I was a kid. And now I'm skating up ice trying to catch him on a 3-on-2. And he's 50 and I'm 25. And I couldn't catch him, so I went to hook him and he hit me with an elbow. And I woke up in the dress room and I said to the trainer, "What happened?" He said, "Oh, Gordy got you with an elbow." So I went out and I said to Gordy, "Hey, that was a great elbow. Thanks." He said, "Yeah, you can tell your kids about that." He says, "Welcome to the league, rookie." I said, "Yeah, remember the dog I was telling you about?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm going home and choke the bastard." But when Gordy retired, Colleen and Mark and Marty asked me to be the toastmaster, the MC at his retirement dinner in Hartford. And I always look at the impact of my career. And it was funny because this past year in seven, well, actually in a couple of years now, in October, they had the 50th reunion of the Quebec Nordiques. And they had the 50th reunion of the same time of the WHA. And they had me at the head table with a fan fest, people coming and signing. And I'm sitting at a table with Bobby Hull, Anders Hedberg, Ulf Nilsson were the big line in Winnipeg. And then Nilsson and Hedberg went on to big careers in New York. And of course, Bobby Hull was Bobby Hull. And then Mark Tardif, who had been captain of Quebec and played in Montreal, and Andre Lacroix, who played in Philadelphia and played in San Diego, WHA, and all these places. And me. And I'm at the head table. And they asked me to speak, and I speak French and I speak English, obviously. So I gave a speech, and I said about Bobby Hull. I said, "Bobby Hull is not just a player in my mind. He's Moses. He led us across the desert to the promised land. And without him, we wouldn't be making the money, and they wouldn't have had the amount of teams that we had. And he broke the system for the betterment of the players." And he gave me a kiss. He gave me a kiss on the cheek. And I always look at that, and people say, "Oh, he beat his wife." And I didn't know him about that stuff. I knew him from golf tournaments, from charity, and I knew him from playing against him. But I really knew him from being a kid watching him play against the Bruins. And so those things are the things that, to me, are the memorable parts of my career. And I could be really boastful, and I just look at it and say, you know, I earned it.
Yep.
And
Absolutely.
when I'm in a situation where I'm at the Erie Pub not too long ago, and a guy with a couple in him said, you know, you were a terrible player and you were a worse referee, and he sort of pushed me a little bit. And I said to him, you know, it'll be a lot cheaper for you to go see the bartender, John. He's a friend of mine. And John, give this guy a beer. I don't need your beer. And I turned, I said to him, it'll be a lot cheaper for you to have that beer than you keep pushing me. You push me once more and you're not going to walk out of here alive. I said, because I don't fight to fight. I'm going to kill you. And I'll dump you in the dumpster and they'll find you tomorrow. And that'll be that. And you know, you just look at this type of thing. And then I said to him, oh, Dallas just scored on a breakaway. You just look at that and you say to yourself, you know, how do you talk like that? Hey, I earned it. And I told the guy, I should borrow your cell phone. He goes, why is that? I said, well, I'm in five Hall of Fames. I'm going to call them all and tell them they made a mistake.
Awesome. I love the
But you
charts.
know, when I was on the ice as a referee, a lot of people that didn't like me criticized me because, you know, I would talk to the players. Like an example, you know, Theo Fleury was 5'5", 5'6", and Shel Samuelson was 6'7". And Fleury used to bitch because he'd say, oh, he elbowed me. I said to him one night, finally, because he slashed Samuelson skating away, and there was a whistle, and they're jarring at each other. And I stepped in, and I said, yeah, I'm talking to you guys. And I tell the other guys, all you other players, screw. Go away. And I looked at Fleury. I said, your head is exactly at the normal height of his elbow. I said, and you're a player that plays hard. So you're running into him all the time. I said, but do you feel better? He says, what do you mean? I said, he elbowed you. I'll say that. Didn't mean to, but he did. And guess what? You slashed him. Do you feel better? Yeah. I said, good, because if you do it again, I'm going to have to come back and I'll babysit the both of you, but I'll put you over in that little box over there. You can sit and talk to each other the rest of the night. You know, and that's how I handled stuff. I told Lemieux, Claude Lemieux from Montreal, he used to dive and he'd feel his teeth and suck hold the crowd and trying to, you know, embellish all the time. I said to him, perfect French, are you an elevator? Vous êtes ascenseur? And he turned around and looked at me. I said, oui, élevé, you're up, you're down, you're up, you're down. And I told Pat Burns that night, I said, you either start coaching him or I'm going to dump him. And that's all there is to it. And 20 years of reffing at all levels, I never threw a coach out. And I only called four bench minors. One was the Brian Murray, he had a lisp, and he kept saying, Paul, Huck, he kept spitting on me. And I finally got tired of that. And the other two guys, Ron Wilson got one on Friday night in Chicago and Saturday in St. Louis. And I played summer hockey with him in Providence. And the other guy was my captain, my friend, and I lived at his house for 2 months. I used to babysit his kids. It was Robbie Fatorik, and he lent me his car to, when I didn't have a car up in Quebec. And he, you know, four bench minors in 20 years, and you just look at, you know, I understood the coaches because my dad was a coach and my grandfather was a coach. And my brother was a coach and I had coached 2 years of high school. So I wasn't going to dump them. We, you know, we have to keep those guys around. I said to Keenan one night when he told me I was a no good, something, something sucker, I turned, I said, I'll have you know, I'm a very good sucker. I said, just ask Brett Hull. And that disarmed him. He turned around. He was laughing so hard he couldn't remember why he was mad at me. And you know, my first week in the league, I threw Yzerman out. His teammate ran Greschner in Madison Square Garden, and Greschner had a bad back. And I had skated with him. I knew him, and I thought that the hit was bad, and I gave the guy a boarding penalty. And he went on to, he was an NHL coach too, coached in Columbus. Anyway, Yzerman came off the bench, and you're not allowed to come off the bench unless you're invited. And he came out and he started calling me all sorts of names and everything. And I turned and I said to him, I said, did you see the elephants behind in the hallway out because the circus was in town? And he said, yeah. I said, well, you're going to get to go shower with them. See ya. And then the next night, Gretzky, even though I knew him, I was in Hartford, and the next night they lost to Hartford, and he was playing for Edmonton. And of course, Hartford wasn't as good as they were later on. And I'm looking at him, and he skates up to me with a minute to go. And he had been chirping a little bit and everything. And I think because he knew me, he thought he'd get away with it. And he said to me, here, this is for you. And he handed me his stick. And I said to him, oh, yeah? I said, here. And I pulled a Sharpie out of my pocket. I said, do you take that in the dressing room and then send it down to me? Oh, you want me to autograph it? I said, no, I want you to leave. I said, and you should go in the dressing room and, practice your autograph because you're out of here. It was only 2 minutes to go in the game. And as I said, Hartford was winning. And I dumped him. And then the next night, Lemieux in Pittsburgh bumped me. And he said, I'm the show. People come to see me. I said, and the captain of Philadelphia was standing there with a whole bunch of players surrounding him. I said, did you hear that? He goes, yeah. I said, all these people, I turned and all these people came to see him. I said, well, they can watch him sit right over there. Boom. I gave him two. He came out of the box, went into overtime, came out of the box, and he skated up. He says, I heard you played in this league. I said, you're from Quebec. You know I did. He says, well, you were a horseshit player. And I turned and I said to him, that may be true. He goes, well, I want you to know you're a worse referee. I said, let me ask you a question. Now all the Flyers are standing around again. I did a complete circle. And I said, are you still the show? These people still come to see you? And he goes, yeah. I said, we're going to have a problem. He goes, what do you mean? We're in overtime. I said, I don't know how we're going to get them all into the shower room. You're done. See ya. So I get home that Sunday. That was like Friday, Saturday, and Wednesday in New York, and the phone rings and it's the president of the league, and he said to me Ziegler, and he said to me Paul, I just wanted to ask you. You just finished your first week full time referee in the NHL. Are we having a problem with superstars? I said no. I said the one guy in New York questioned my sexual preference. The second guy tried to embarrass me in front of his team by handing me his stick. I said, and the third guy bumped me. I said, and I just think you should know this. I said, because my grandfather said this once. When they criticize or belittle me, they're not, I'm your representative. They're really saying it about you. I said, and I felt that it was at the start a chance for me to set the pace. I said, and when you throw out the three biggest names in the league, I said, I can promise you the rest of the year will be like cream cheese. And he said to me, I hadn't thought of that. Have a good year. And I became friends with him. And if you remember in 87, that was the year that they had the yellow sweaters in Jersey and Schoenfeld and Koharski and all that. And Ziegler was missing from the game. And they made a big point of it in the New York press. And I saw him at the finals, and it was in the Ritz in Boston. And he was in the buffet line, and I was standing behind him. And he turned around and hi, Paul, how are you? I said, I'm great. He said, I see I'm getting criticized heavily for not being at that Bruins jersey game. What do you think? I turned and I said to him, I think you're the president of the league. I said, and I think that wherever you were is the place you were supposed to be. And I knew where he was. My brother was U.S. Customs. My brother told me that he had left New York and flown to England because his son was facing a challenge with drugs, and he was in some rehab over there. And Ziegler looked at me and he said, "Thank you." And he shook my hand. So you got to have respect. And you know what? Gretzky and I are great friends. Lemieux and I have played golf together. Yzerman doesn't like me still, and that's fine. It doesn't bother me. I don't care. And Shanahan doesn't like me, and there are a bunch of guys that don't like me. But when I came back after having had cancer in 1998, and I did my first game in Boston, and I came on the ice, and I started to ref. And at the first TV timeout, they showed that Hockey Fights Cancer ad, and it was me at the New Garden in '98. I got a standing ovation from 18,000 people.
Yep.
Bullock skated over and gave me a tap on the pads. So you look at things like that, and for a guy from Dorchester that started out with my sister's white skates with picks on them, I did okay.
Before we let you go, Paul, can I get a couple of questions from the guys?
Sure.
Ed, what do you got?
Oh, I'm going to ask you, Paul, who's the funniest player that just would say some just funny stuff that would get you cracking up out there? Just like, man, that was just funny, you know?
Well, the guy that came off the bench and scored the overtime goal and beat the Bruins in the Stanley Cup playoffs after not having played the whole game, and then he came off Peter Klima. He had been picked up for operating under. And I worked his first game after he had been jailed and then suspended, and then he came back, and I was out there, and I looked at him and I said, "Welcome back. If you need a ride home, let me know." And he said to me, "Don't get in my way." He said, I'm just going the speed limit tonight." And then Eddie Belfour, he got picked up in, I think, in Dallas once, and I worked his first game, and then he came back, and he was in the net, and he, started the game, and I skated by him, and I said, "Hey, Ed, it's good, Eddie the Eagle." And I said to him, "Hey, Ed, it's good to see you back. How you doing? All right?" He goes, "Yeah." He had offered the cop $20,000 to drive him home, and I said to him, "Listen, I knew I was going to see you tonight. I want you to know I got a big, beautiful rental outside, and I got friends on the Dallas police, and they said they'd give us an escort. So I'll take 5,000 if want to ride." It's kind of funny because I always enjoyed being out there, and a lot of people have said when they see pictures of me that, I always seem to be smiling. And they asked me, was I really that happy? And I said, "Well, I'm in a rink, and that's where my friends are.
Yep.
And that's where I chose to make my life." And life is short, and it's come to an end. But a kid from a U.S. college, he went to school with my son, and they played together. And he had leukemia. He set the record for scoring his freshman year at this college. I won't mention his name, but he was suffering, and he couldn't play sophomore year. And I'm a trustee at the school. It's a prep school, Canadian prep school, and even that honor is an honor. And I called the kid up and I said to him, "I've been through this, and you've got to, I was on chemo. I had a port in my chest. Bork came up and tapped me on the chest. I almost fainted on the ice because it's a, I had a bag of chemo and I was working. I didn't miss any games." But I said to the kid, "You can get by this." And I would call him up. And then I figured, you know what? maybe he's tired of hearing from me. So I call a few friends of mine, Bobby Sweeney at the Bruins, and I asked him if he could get Bork to call because it was a kid from Quebec, and then I called a few other friends. And guess what? Lemieux called him. Gretzky called him. Bork called him. And I hadn't even asked this guy, but Bobby Orr called him. And I just look at that. And the kid's grad, he did well. I went and watched him play some games this year. And he played at Harvard and he played at Brown and I watched him and he was good. And I gave him some words of encouragement, but I picked out a few things that he should work on and he did. And he sent me a hat and a golf shirt. And that's like getting the Medal of Honor or an Oscar. It's an honor. It's a tribute. And yet it's not because we're supposed to help each other, aren't we?
Absolutely.
I agree 100%.
And you know what? I've been through that cancer thing and a couple times, and it's not easy. And it's the coldest day when they tell you that you're sick. My son was born on February 22nd, 98. On February 23rd, the doctor took his glasses off. I went in to see him on my way to the airport to pick up my mother-in-law, and my wife had just given birth at midnight. So I got like 2 hours sleep, and it was during the Olympics in 98. And he took his glasses off and he said to me, I'm showing him the pictures of the kid and my wife, and he said to me, I'm afraid to tell you that you're not going to see his first Christmas. You know, I don't care how tough a guy you are. And I don't care how confident you are. The aspect of that makes the day arctic. It's cold. And it's one of the greatest challenges that I've ever had to face. But I'm a team guy. I had great doctors and I had family support and I had the league. And I had that other part of me. I worked for Putin and Medvedev in Russia. I ran the KHL for 3 years, and they were mad at me one night. And I stood up, said my piece, didn't back off. And Putin asked me, "Are you from Russia?" I said, "No." He goes, "Well, you don't blink, and you don't seem afraid." I said, "No, I'm from Dorchester. You should look it up." And guess what? This year, with Trump in, and I went to school, I know Trump. He went to Penn, I went to Penn. And he used to come see me in the dress room at New York. You know, I live in Hyannis Port, right near the Kennedys. And, you know, I'm not a politician. I told Menino that once. Politics is your game, hockey's mine. Let's stay in our own backyards. But Putin said to me, You're not Russian?" I said, "No." He says, "You're not afraid of me?" I said, "You just pay me what you owe me and I'll go home tomorrow if you want." And guess what? That was in 2016. I had a brain tumor. That's why I came home to be operated on. And I did. And I was fine. I couldn't work for a while, but I'm okay. And, you know, I keep telling my good friend, the fellow that I asked to do my eulogy, was my teammate at Penn. He's Speaker of the House of the State of Rhode Island, Johnny Harwood, and a lawyer and a good friend of mine and his family. And he said to me that only the good die young. You'll be around a long time. But it's kind of funny because, you know, I've been through the challenges, yet I survived, and I always think that there's a reason why I did, and it was to help Hockey Fights Cancer and talk to kids that are sick and others that are sick, because I, you know, we're all in the same plane, we're all going in the same direction, and if I can make it, you can make it. Don't quit, and I never quit. And that's it's funny. Clark Gillies said to me once, "How come you and I never fought?" He said, "We played against each other and you fought everybody on my team, but you never fought me." I said, "Well, you never did anything to piss me off. Second of all, you played hard and played with class." I said, "But mostly," I said, "I saw you fight." I said, "I didn't want to get killed." And he said to me, "Yeah, I saw you too. I saw you fight. I would have had to kill you 9 times. You kept getting up." But, you know, I'm a fortunate guy. And when it looked like it wasn't going to happen, and I was going to leave, you know, I said to the athletic director at Northeastern, a guy named Roby, you know, I grew up in this rink. My grandfather skated here. My dad ref coached. I played here, took my first strides here, and doesn't look like I'm going to make it. And if I don't make it, I would like to have my funeral and my wake and funeral at the arena. And he said, they agreed. And Jimmy Madigan was the coach, and now he's the athletic director. And he called me this past year and he said, "Did you read the Globe today?" And I said, "No." He said, "Guess what?" He said, "We're tearing down the arena and we're building a new rink." I said, "Oh my gosh." I said, "Well, I hope I get a chance to take the last skate before you tear it down." He said, "Well, I was thinking more if you're going to have your funeral, you better die this year, otherwise you won't get to have it at the arena."
Tom, do you have any questions for Stewie?
Yeah, what advice do you give young officials trying to break into pro hockey?
Well, I don't give them advice to break into pro hockey. I give them advice on how to be effective officials on the ice. And I tell them to feel the game and read the book and then leave it in the dressing room. Because there are too many people, and it's even like the same with the police. And having been a cop, I can speak with some authority on it, that they're too bookbound. You know, feel the game and understand the players and try to get so that you're in great position. You know, the interesting thing about the NCAA Frozen Four final game, and those four officials are all kids that I started in officiating, three of the four, and they're from Boston. And I called them before the game, and I told them, "What's the one thing that I'm going to tell you?" And they're all listening to me on speakerphone. Get to the net. Going back to the Montreal game, that I missed that goal. Guess what? Positioning sells calls. The money's at the net. They'll forget a hook and a hold at center ice, but they won't forget the goal that you missed up. And even don't count on replay. Anybody that's had a computer or a cell phone or a flashlight, batteries and wires fail. But if you're 3 feet from the net, make the call and you trust yourself. And that's where positioning sells calls. I did one of the first games. I did a couple of games first. I did the first four-man game since in the modern era, because they used to have two referees and a linesman back in the day when my grandfather reffed. But I did a game in Madison Square Garden. It was the first replay game. And the guy took the shot. Minnesota was playing the Rangers. And the guy took the shot, and it came off of the net, it came off of the goal, and they took it up ice and scored. The Rangers scored, and the replay official was a former NHL linesman, Hall of Fame guy, Matt Pavlich, and he called down, and I was at the penalty box, and he said, "I want to talk to the referee." He says, "You got to disallow the Rangers goal because Minnesota shot the puck just before that and it went in." I said, "Really? It went in? Well, why do you think it went in?" Because when he shot it, it came back off of the goal, and it was sort of wobbling and wiggling. And I turned and I said to him, "Oh yeah?" So you think it must have hit something, huh? He goes, yeah. I said, does your TV camera show my hand? He goes, what do you mean? I said, I had my hand on the crossbar. It hit my finger, and I held my finger up, and it's broken. I said, so that's no goal, and the Rangers scored. And I went over and told Bobby Gainey was the coach of Minnesota. I went over and told him. I said, see my finger? That shot didn't go in. It hit me. And that's why I always say positioning sells calls. And I learned that in my first game. And I tell young referees that. The other thing, and I tell people this, especially young, it could be players or referees or anyone. If you want to make it, you've got to be the best skater on the ice. You've got to be able to skate. And go, go, go. I had a game in Montreal one night. We dropped the puck at 7:05. And at 7:25, the whistle went, the horn went, and they handed me back the puck. 20 minutes with no TV timeouts, no offsides, no icings. The guys from Hockey Night in Canada were pissed off. They didn't get any of their ads in. But I refereed that game and I skated. And it was Montreal playing Vancouver, and it was Pavel Bure, and he was the rocket. He could fly, and the Russian rocket they called him. And I could skate with those guys. And I'm telling you right now, I was a powerful skater, and I was a big guy. I was 6'1", 210, and strong. And Tkachuk, the father, said to me one night in Phoenix, they were playing Detroit in a playoff game, stay out of my way or I'll run you over. I said, no. I said, you're from Charlestown? He goes, yeah. I said, really? I said, yeah. So that night, he short-turned into me, and we collided. It took him about 5 minutes to get him off the ice. He was out cold. He ran into me, and I was skating full stride, and he short-turned into me. And I put my arm up. I hit him with a forearm right in the chest, knocked the wind right out of him. And he's on the ice, and they're pulling his pants and got the smelling salts going and everything. I leaned over. I said, you're not from Charlestown. You're from Medford. Was about 235. But I played football in high school, and I was a good football player and tough. And, baseball, I was a catcher, and if you run down third baseline and run into me, and I played in the Park League and I played down the Cape, and I was strong. When I was 15, 16 years old, I worked as an ice man, pushing 300-pound bars of ice, loading tractor trailers, and then taking the tongs and flipping it and throwing it into the crusher and the cuber, and I was strong. And fitness, the reason I survived the cancer, I was on chemo every day. I took a treatment every day for 8 months, one in the morning and one at night. And and I drank gallons and gallons of Gatorade because the chemo, your body sheds the bad cells, and you do it by going the, you have to take a pee. Well, guess what? I used to drink like three, four Gatorades during the game in the penalty box. I'd just go over and drink it. And I learned something from Frank Advari, and he said it to me in Springfield one night when I didn't make a call. And he says, if you don't have the guts to make a call here, how are you going to do it at Madison Square Garden? And he said to me, he asked me a question and I started to give him an answer. He goes, excuses are for losers. So I lived by that. And I'm, that old thing, and now everybody uses it to be transparent. No, I be outstanding, be upright, and own what you got. And I said when I made the Hall of Fame speech, I always disagree with folks that say, I'm going to give you 110%. You can't. There's no 110. You can give you 100, but you can't give 110. But But the bigger sin would be to only go 90. And I
Absolutely.
said that in front of everybody. I said, I gave you 100% every night. And what saved me when I was sick and why I could still go, and I was sick, they said I was going to die. And I made the funeral arrangements, and I went to the church and all of that, you know, and I had the arena all set. And I was in great shape. I used to ride the bike 20, 30 miles a day. I used to skate before the games. I'd go to the rink and skate for 45 minutes before the games with the lights off, which is like what I did when I was a kid at the Boston Arena. I had a key like Rudy. I went in the back door.
So, Stewie, before we wrap it up with you, I just want to ask the guys closing thank yous to Stewie for coming on.
Absolutely. And to let everyone know where we can get your book.
Yeah, it's called You Want to Go, and it's on Amazon, and I have another one coming out. It's called You Want to Go Again.
So, speaking of that, we'll have to have you on again.
Yeah, and then the other book, I wrote a story about Christmas and hockey for Huffington Post, and National Public Radio read it, and they turned it into a Christmas Eve story, and it was about my first pair of skates and how my dad tricked me into trying on a pair of boys' skates, and then Christmas Day, just like the Red Rifle, you know, with the
Ralphie,
kid that,
Christmas story.
Yeah, Ralphie yeah. got the rifle. My father said, I think there's one more behind the couch there. And it was a pair of Hides skates made in Cambridge with blue skate tips on it. And they were boy skates. And man, oh man, I'm clumping around the living room on Christmas morning. You know, I can't wait to go skate. We had a rink in the backyard. We had a key to the arena. So we went and skated. And, you know, I had a pretty magical life. Let me put it this way to you. I walk into places like the White House and Trump says hi to me. Or I walk into, you know, Madison Square Garden and Joey Mullen's father's working on the crew. And I knew him when I was playing. And, you know, you just think of all the different people I've met and how lucky I've been. It's just been an amazing life in many ways. And I got two great kids and a beautiful wife. Although I did marry the only woman from Minnesota that doesn't like hockey. She is the reason they built the Mall of America.
What I want to tell you is we're lucky to have you on. That's what I want to say. We're lucky for you to share your time with us. We're lucky to have you on just telling stories, chirping, talking hockey, and you know we'd love to circle the wagons. And actually, Andre Lacroix is supposed to come on next week or the week after, and he says to say hello too. So
he's a great guy, and you know I knew him when he was playing in the WHA. Of course, I watched him play in the National League, and you know I don't know how many points he had. He had to have like 700-800 points, but the acknowledgement and the respect from those guys. I said to the premier of Quebec, who was a separatist, we were at dinner one night and he saw us and called us over and Rennie Levesque. And I was with Jamie Hislop, played at UNH, and Reggie Thomas. They were both WHA teammates, and then they played with me in Quebec. And Levesque said to me, how is it for you as an Englishman to be here in Quebec? I said, well, I'm not English. I said, and I got these guys, and I reached over and I showed them. I said, you know, when you have enough George Washingtons, everybody speaks French, but they all learn English in a hurry. And I said, and by the way, I said, I'm a kid from Boston, and I'm playing in the rink that they built for Jean Beliveau. I'm playing in the rink that was paid for by Guy Lafleur. I said, and you know what? Now I'm here. And I get here, and the province and the city had to add 5,000 seats.
That's the thing we love is that's what we love about doing these interviews is we love the stories. The stories is what makes the hockey lore go. Just great, just chirping with the boys, telling great, great stories, whether they were emotionally connected or funny, like the Kachuk story. It's just great having you on, Paul. I cannot emphasize enough. From a lifelong hockey fan, I watched pretty much your entire referee career. I mean, as a kid, I started watching in 1977. Even though I'm from Massachusetts, when you mentioned the Flyers, these guys know I'm a huge Philadelphia Flyers fan. So that those stories hit home with me. So I can't thank you.
And I was just driving the Zamboni, and I'd help the trainers with the equipment in the rink, and they practiced, and they had one bag of equipment, and they'd take it from the rink over to the Spectrum, and I would help them load the van and all of that. And I got to know Freddie Shiro and Mike Nicoluk, and God rest his soul, Barry Ashby. He taught me how to play defense. He'd take me out, and Rick McLeish, I used to drop pucks for him, and he taught me about how to win faceoffs. And it's kind of funny because people who run hockey teams don't understand that the officials that were on the ice, especially a guy like me for 20 years plus eight playing, I know the game. I'd be just as good a coach as anybody they have. Plus, I can communicate with these guys. And the funny thing is that the president of the Bruins said to me one day, "Well, you were just a referee." I said, "Yeah, I was 3 feet from them, and your scouts are 300 feet."
Right.
Watching from the press box. I
Right.
said, so it just tells me, he didn't know much about hockey anyway. I won't even mention his name. But the fact of the matter is that the game is, to me, and I had a chance to play anything. I could have played baseball. Sparky Anderson said to me, I used to take batting practice. I was friends with Pete Rose and Ray Knight and a lot of the guys from the Big Red Machine, because they practiced right next to us. And I would go golfing and stuff. And I used to get a chance, and teams would come in town, and Willie Stargell and the Penguin, the Pirates and such. I could hit, and I could have played. But like I said to Sparky Anderson, "Don't you have that guy Johnny Bench? You're not going to need me catching.
Right.
Catch
Oh,
the
we use you at first." I said, "Oh, yeah, you get Concepcion at first. I don't think you need me there either." So, but I could have played football. I look at some of the guys that are playing. I could have put on 25, 30 pounds and played if I wanted to. It wasn't like I didn't want to. I enjoyed it, but I loved hockey, and I still do. And that's why I'm sitting here watching the game and talking to you guys.
Right.
Oh,
Yeah.
The only difference is my old man, he was the master of going to the game and talking out of the side of his mouth. He'd be saying, "See that? Did you see that one?" Huh? Because he watched the whole game. He never took his eyes off the puck and the players. And he'd talk to you out of the side of his mouth, And back in those days, they didn't have high glass, and you never know, you might get whacked with the puck. Yeah.
Very true, very true.
So listen, it's been a pleasure. We'll
Paul,
talk
thank
to
you
you,
so much.
fellas. I hope
Really
I
appreciate
didn't
your
rattle
time.
on
Thank
too
you.
long,
No,
but
a lot of absolutely. It was absolute pleasure. I mean, friend of the show from now on. Next time I run into you at one of these card shows, I'm gonna come introduce myself in person, and we'll talk more.
very good. All right.
Thank you, Paul.
Nighty night.
Thank you,
And
Stu.
Thanks, Paul.
we'll talk to you soon, and happy Memorial Day.
Yes,
Yeah.
sir.
You too.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
I
Paul.
know.
See ya.
That was
Fellas,
awesome.
that guy doesn't stop talking.
That was awesome.